From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And our top story today continues to be Greece.
The country's future in the European Union and the Eurozone is in doubt today after yesterday's vote against austerity in Greece. There's pressure now to restart bailout talks with creditors. European finance ministers will meet tomorrow to discuss the crisis. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Athens with the latest. And Mark, so much has happened in the last 24 hours. But what is the mood right now in Athens, in Greece? Are people still celebrating the referendum vote?
Some of them are still celebrating, and the feeling among many of those who voted no is that they are delighted that Greece finally thumbed its nose at the Eurozone and stood up for itself. But even among those who voted no, and certainly among those who voted yes, there is a lot of apprehension about the way ahead. There is a realization, I think, that there is little time for triumphalism, that there is the emergency now of what to do with the Greek banks, which are on the last legs of their funds, really. And so they need an injection of emergency money from the European Central Bank within the next few days if they are to stay afloat. The problem is that the ECB, by its rules, only lends to banks if they are solvent or if the country is in a bailout program, neither of which Greece is. So there are frantic discussions now in the European Central Bank, and a Eurozone summit to be held in Brussels tomorrow, Tuesday, to try to work out how to bring some political stability now to Greece and how to stop the Greek banks from caving in, which would really hasten Greece's exit from the Eurozone.
And what is life like on the ground now for people? There have been many, many days now of these capital controls. People can only take out 60 euros a day. Are you able to go to stores and shops and restaurants and buy the things that you need in Greece right now, or are they running out of supplies?
Largely, it's still okay. You can still go and buy whatever you like, and the cafes are still doing a good trade, and the shops are open. It is a normal place in many ways. But, of course, there are queues outside most bank ATM machines. And even though last week the government very confidently asserted that the banks would reopen tomorrow, Tuesday, it's simply not going to happen. And we've now had bank sources suggesting that the banks will be closed at least until the end of the week. And that presents another problem, Jeremy, because with the banks closed and capital controls continuing, the Greek economy is suffering greatly and is even in a more parlous state, a worse state than it was a few weeks ago. Added to that, of course, amidst the political instability, tax revenues have plummeted. And so now to actually strike a deal to get Greece through the mess, through this current mess, is much, much harder than it would have been 3 or 4 weeks ago. So it's not simply a question at the Eurozone summit tomorrow of just kind of going back to the deal that was presented and sort of tweaking it. They're going to have to rework this deal completely if anything is to budge. And added to that, you have a lot of scepticism from the German government that about the referendum itself. Sources in the German government saying that, as far as they're concerned, nothing has changed. They're not going to start talking about writing off Greek debt. So we'll have to see what can be discussed behind closed doors tomorrow and whether the deep divisions between the two sides can be bridged.
So what's your sense, Mark? You've been covering this for years from Athens and around Europe. Do you think Greece is going to leave the euro?
It's a very, very difficult question as ever. On the one hand, when you look at Greece's situation, you'd be inclined to say yes, because if the European Central Bank can't lend to Greece, if there is not the political will now to keep Greece in the Eurozone because it has defied the Eurozone by holding this referendum, then it would be quite an easy decision in some ways for the European Central Bank to say, OK, time's up, and Greece would have to start printing its own money and devalue and inflation would soar, etc. On the other hand, you have the ideological element of this, which is that the Eurozone, the single currency, was created as a project of now 19 countries with the idea that it would bind them together forever financially. And it is a one-way street. When you join, you're in. There is no way out. There's not even a treaty to leave the Eurozone. And once Greece leaves, then other countries could that run into trouble also could start to leave. And then really the whole project begins to fall apart. And given the fact that Germany and France basically created the Eurozone themselves, neither Angela Merkel nor François Hollande are going to want to have on their CV creation and destruction of the Eurozone. So, the Eurozone has spent 5 years and 240 billion euros keeping Greece inside the Eurozone. Are they simply going to bid it farewell now? unlikely straight away. I think there's going to be one final push. If that doesn't work, well, then maybe yes. But I still think we're a few weeks away from that.
Well, when you say destruction of the Eurozone, is that what's at stake? If Greece leaves, is it the destruction of the Eurozone eventually?
Well, look, the firewalls have been put in place since 2012 or 2013 at the height of the Eurozone crisis to prevent the kind of mass contagion that everybody feared back then. When I was living here in 2012, 2013, when there were riots and anti-bailout protests the whole time, there was the fear that if Greece were to leave, then immediately there would be a knock-on effect on other indebted countries that were still in the bailout program, like Portugal and Ireland. Since then, those countries have left their bailout programs, and Ireland is now the fastest growing economy in Western Europe. Added to that, the banks have been recapitalized in other parts of Europe, etc. So there have been mechanisms put in place. But the fear is still that if Greece were to leave, the borrowing costs of other countries would suddenly go through the roof. And then you set a precedent that once a country runs into financial problems, then they are shown the door of the Eurozone. And really, none of the countries that created the Eurozone and now lead it today want that to be the case.
The BBC's Mark Lowen speaking to us from Athens. It's going to be a very interesting next couple of days there. Mark, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Well, Congress is back at work tomorrow with lots to do before the annual August break. Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent, is here to tick through. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And it strikes me that it's funny, like Greece, as another seeming intractable negotiation on the table with Iran. Let's start there. Six world powers plus Iran have to reach a deal tomorrow on reducing Iran's nuclear capabilities. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry yesterday in Austria.
If we don't get a deal, if we don't have a deal, if there's absolute intransigence, if there's an unwillingness to move on the things that are important, President Obama has always said we'll be prepared to walk away. It's not what anybody wants. We want to get an agreement.
So, Ron Elving, remind us, what are those things that are important?
The six world powers that you mentioned are interested in reducing Iran's existing nuclear fuel stockpile and also limiting its ability to produce new fuel. And they want to create a one-year, if you will, arm's length zone, so that even if the Iranians wanted to, they would not be able to immediately shift to the production of nuclear weapons. That plus, of course, a regime of verification and inspection that would be enough to satisfy all of the critics, not only in the six world powers, but also in places such as Israel. Israel is not a party to these negotiations.
Yeah, well, what will satisfy Congress? Because it has to be reviewed by Congress before sanctions can be lifted. And here's Senator Tom Cotton, the Republican of Arkansas, speaking yesterday on ABC's This Week.
And this is not just two businesses negotiating together. This is not like Russell Wilson and the Seattle Seahawks trying to reach a contract that makes everyone happy. Iran should have faced a simple choice. They dismantle their nuclear program entirely, or they face economic devastation and military destruction of their nuclear facilities.
So, Ron, tell us more about what Congress is likely to do.
That simple choice that Senator Cotton would like to see might very well have been preferable to a lot of people in the United States Congress, most Republicans, many Democrats, who take the position, like the Israeli government, that any negotiation with these six world powers and at this particular time would probably not be able to produce a good deal, and there would never be any satisfaction with it. I think when you say any kind of deal, you're really meaning any kind of deal. There are others, however, particularly on the Democratic side, who are willing to look at the details. And that's true also of some Republicans. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker has been among those who said, we can find some kind of terms that would give us a preferable situation. So Congress still has this power, either 30 days or 60 days, depending on when we see an agreement, that can review this particular detailed agreement once we get it. And really, a lot of what we learned back in April was preliminary. So there's a great deal yet to be determined before we see whether or not Congress can possibly swallow this.
Highway funding. At the end of this month, the government loses authority to send transportation funds to the states for highway repairs. We've been here before.
Oh, my. Yes. The Peter Peterson Foundation, which measures fiscal things in Washington, has determined there have been more than 30 different kinds of stopgap funding for the highways in just the last 6 years. So this has become one of those cans that Congress kicks on a regular basis.
And what do you think they'll do?
I think on this particular occasion, they're going to have to pass this again as a short-term funding gap, because the permanent solution, the long-term solution, involves getting some new revenues. They could raise that gasoline tax that hasn't been raised in 22 years. It's been stuck at 18.4%, and that could, 18.4 cents per gallon, not percent of the total amount that you're paying, but 18.4 cents per gallon. And if they don't raise that, they're going to have to look to something in the general funds again. And that, of course, just contributes to the deficit.
Well, I hate to do this to you. We got about a minute for the Export-Import Bank, which Democrats want to reauthorize. Conservatives don't. They want to chip away at government, they say, by ending it.
A lot of business-oriented conservatives actually like the Ex-Im Bank, and I suspect in the end they'll be able to get it attached to a must-pass bill and get it authorized again. But what it does is it authorizes payments to subsidize American products that are purchased by foreign entities, governments or private companies. And a lot of people on the libertarian conservative side, the really anti-government, anti-tax people, think that's a bad thing. They don't want the government involved in that. They call it corporate welfare. That's been a pretty powerful phrase in American politics.
Okay, well, you're going to be hearing about that in the next few weeks. Ron Elving, NPR's senior editor and correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, we're starting a series of conversations about Iraq, about the rise of ISIS, and about whether the U.S. should be getting more or less involved in the fight. Our first guest is someone who has lost a son in the Iraq War. Andrew Basevich is a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam. He's professor of international relations and history at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. His son, Andrew, was a first lieutenant in the Army when he was killed in Iraq in 2007. Professor Basevich, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
And as you look at the fight against ISIS going on in Iraq right now, what do you see?
Well, I see the verdict on the U.S. intervention of 2003. When the George W. Bush administration decided to go into Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein, it did so with an expectation that removing Saddam would somehow not simply pacify Iraq itself, but would lead to some broader benefits in terms of calming the situation in the region. And I think the rise of ISIS as the new threat really is the ultimate demonstration of the American failure in the previous Iraq War.
So when you hear people say that one of the reasons that ISIS has been able to gain power in Iraq is because the Obama administration pulled out the troops too quickly, how would you respond to that?
I'd say that the reason ISIS exists is because the George W. Bush administration introduced U.S. forces into Iraq in the first place. More broadly, our Iraq War, or Bush's Iraq War, broke Iraq, ended its stability. And the Iraqi government that we have created, the Iraqi army that we have created, has proven itself unable to cope with the instability that we created. ISIS is simply a symptom or a manifestation of that instability.
Was there anything that we could have done with the Iraqi army to prepare them for this battle, though? Is there something we could have done differently that would have created an army of Iraqis to ward off threats in the future?
Well, any effective fighting force is effective if it can claim two qualities. And the one quality is the capacity to fight, the skills, the weaponry, the wherewithal. But the second quality is a will to fight. We spent several years building up this new Iraqi army, and I'm frankly not in a position to question whether or not the training was adequate or whether we provided them with sufficient arms. My sense is we did a lot in that arena. But I'm not sure that we ever had the ability to inculcate that will to fight, to persuade young Iraqi men that the nation of Iraq, the state that we created, the government apparatus that we created, was worth fighting and dying for. So the argument that the current mess is Obama's fault seems to me has merit only if people making that argument are also willing to argue that we should have stayed in Iraq far longer than we did, with a far greater military presence. And frankly, there was no willingness on the part of the American people to undertake that endless occupation.
So what do we do now?
Well, my own view is that we need to begin by making a sober and realistic assessment of exactly what sort of threat we're facing. And I think that the most important point to recognize is that as vile and as vicious as ISIS clearly is, it does not represent an immediate threat to the United States of America. It has no air force, it has no navy, it has a relatively small army, no weapons of mass destruction, no ability to project power across the oceans to threaten the United States. And so we need to have a sober appreciation of exactly what they are able to do. Now, that said, ISIS does represent a profound threat to the region. And it seems to me that recognizing that should lead us to examine more carefully whether or not there are not actors within the region who have a greater interest than we do in taking up this fight and who may have the capacity to do so. In other words, this is a burden that should be borne by nations within this region who do not wish to see this supposed new caliphate succeed.
But what about when we see terrorist attacks in other countries that are ISIS-inspired, even if they're homegrown? Is there something that we ought to be doing in the region to stop the threat that exists in Western countries?
Yes, there is. Of course, and your question did not necessarily imply that requires military action on our part. But the discourse in this country, when one says, well, what should we do? What should the United States do with regard to some problem? Almost automatically, the conversation then shifts to questions of military options. You know, should we redouble our efforts to advise and train the Iraqi army? Should we increase the level of bombing? Should we put American boots on the ground? And I would want to push back against the notion that doing something necessarily means doing something militarily. And I push back on that because it seems to me that the historical record over the past several decades is quite clear, an historical record that shows that U.S. military involvement in the region simply does not work. When we intervene directly or indirectly, the result is not greater stability, it's greater instability. And therefore, the question, what should we do, it seems to me, is one that should spur us to think creatively about non-military means to address this military threat, non-military means on our part. And there, I think, again, the key is to prod parties in the region, and let's get specific, to prod Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are adversaries in very many respects, to get those two countries to recognize that they have a common interest in destroying ISIS, and that interest in destroying ISIS, at least in the near term, should take precedence over a rivalry between those two countries that is deeply rooted, is not going to go away, but may not be the issue of the moment.
We are speaking with military analyst Andrew Bacevich, who's a professor of international relations and history at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. And Professor Bacevich, if President Obama were to come out tomorrow and say, I'm pulling all troops out of Iraq, would that be something you'd support?
Well, I wouldn't support anything done abruptly. What I would support is President Obama coming announcing tomorrow that the United States recognizes the failure of its effort to restabilize the greater Middle East by relying on U.S. military power. In other words, that he indicated that the direction of U.S. policy henceforth will be towards reducing our military footprint, reducing our military obligations to the region. And that's a project that would no doubt take some considerable amount of time to pull off. So it's not what we're going to do tomorrow that we should discuss.
We've been talking about Iraq and the modern country of Iraq and the borders that exist. But of course, these days, the border between Iraq and Syria is almost non-existent. You've got fighters coming in and going out. Should we be talking about Iraq and Syria as one thing now, as one entity?
I think the answer is no. Not to contradict your point, which is a good point. But we have an interest in preserving the system of states that exists in the Middle East. Now, that system of states was created by European imperialists back in the early part of the 20th century to serve imperial interests. And it is flawed in many ways. And no country is more flawed in that regard than Iraq itself, which barely qualifies as a nation state. Nonetheless, there is no viable alternative to that system of states. And therefore, we have an interest in preserving a place called Syria. We have an interest in preserving a place called Iraq. It is important to recognize that ISIS poses a threat to both of those states and more broadly to the system of states. And that's why ISIS, from a strategic point of view, that's why ISIS needs to be opposed. But to sort of ignore the boundaries strikes me as analytically the wrong way to go.
That's Andrew Basevich, a retired Army colonel who is professor of international relations and history at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies, one of our conversations that we're having this week about Iraq. Andrew Basevich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow we'll hear a very different view from former George W. Bush advisor Elliot Abrams.
I think the developments of the last 6 years are not the responsibility of President Bush. They are the responsibility of the president in power now.
We'll hear that conversation tomorrow. Your thoughts are welcome at hereandnow.org.
And so far, global financial markets are responding with caution, not panic, to yesterday's no vote on more austerity measures for Greece, although oil and commodity prices did tumble in response. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News is here with more on the financial repercussions. Hi, Jill.
Good afternoon.
And we know financial markets love certainty, which we don't have here. No one knows if the Greeks will convince creditors to come up with a new, less painful bailout, or if they won't, and Greece will exit the EU, drop the euro. So what can we expect from European markets as these negotiations continue?
I think the word is going to be volatility. I know U.S. markets are fairly muted, okay? But, you know, when we were checking the futures last night, it looked like the Dow was down a couple hundred. We see European markets close down about 1.5 to 2%. But the reality is the next 48 hours are going to be really interesting. We had such a surprise this morning. The finance minister of Greece resigned. I mean, he got the vote that he wanted, the no, and yet he resigned. Why did he do that? Well, he said because Europeans put pressure on Greece to have him booted. And looks like Greece said okay, because everyone does want to get back to the negotiation table. Looks like that's going to start, at least in part, tomorrow.
Yeah, it seems as if he was thrown a bit under the bus.
Absolutely.
In order to maybe get a deal. But you mentioned that already in Asia, commodities and oil prices did take a sharp turn in response to the vote. What is the connection?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the Chinese stock market, since about mid-June when it peaked, is down about 30%. That is a full-blown bear market, everyone. I know it hurts. But you know what? The Chinese stock market had more than doubled, so quit your crying. No crocodile tears here, okay? And part of the reason that oil is falling is twofold. One is that as the U.S. dollar strengthens, that's a negative for commodities. But the other is that there is some fear that Chinese consumption of oil is going to be reduced because the country is going through some sort of, I don't know, rebalancing. And honestly, the stock market dropping by 30% shouldn't be something that we think is going to spread here. Our market has not doubled in the last year, so it's been quite volatile. Some of these things are all jumbled in as one mess, but they have separate, distinct issues associated with
them. Well, when does the connection get made? Let's say that Greek Greece does leave the EU and drops the euro for the drachma, but the U.S. doesn't have significant economic ties to Greece. But where might the connection be felt? Where might the pain be more felt?
Well, I think that we start watching the European stock markets and the peripheral stock markets and bond markets, meaning the markets in Portugal, Spain, and in Italy. Those three markets are the ones that everyone's sort of looking as the canary in a coal mine. And here's what I mean by that. Okay, we know Greece is a hot mess, right? And they borrowed a ton of money, and they're not going to pay it back. You know, they're going to pay some portion of it, but there's no way that they're going to pay $270 billion back to the Eurogroup. Not happening, no way. The question becomes, if they leave the Eurozone, will investors start to say, oh, wait a minute, this is what happens. This is the pathway out. This is what Portugal, Italy, and Spain could do. I'm going to stop lending to them. Those markets come under pressure. That's when we start to see contagion. And I think that's what we keep our eyes on. Look, it's not going to be fun for our markets either, but it should be relatively, relatively contained. Don't sell. Stick to your game plan.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. We will keep watching this story as we have been now for months. Thank you.
Take care.
In the wake of the Supreme Court's decision upholding the constitutionality of Obamacare, there has been a flurry of merger activity in the health insurance industry, including the announcement last Friday that Aetna, the third largest insurer, will buy Humana, the fourth largest insurer in this country, for more than $30 billion. Joining us now to discuss is Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Jeremy.
And is this a coincidence that these mergers, and this is not the only one, by the way, there was this other one, Centene and Health Net getting together, that these announcements are coming so soon after the big decision from the Supreme Court that essentially keeps the Affordable Care Act intact?
No, it's definitely not a coincidence. These merger sort of talks have been going on for quite a while, but I think a lot of the pulling of the final trigger was on hold until sort of the insurance community would see whether the Supreme Court would kind of plunge the insurance market into chaos by disallowing subsidies in the states run by the Federal Health Exchange. They didn't do that. That basically left the status quo in place. So a lot of these mergers that I think were sort of well on their way to happening went ahead and took place, or at least they announced they are taking place. There are many steps to go through before they actually happen.
Right. And it brings up the question of what the Affordable Care Act has meant for these companies in general. Have they benefited? Have they been hurt? What's been the overall impact of Obamacare on the health insurance companies?
Well, the health insurance industry, not surprisingly, is doing pretty well. That's because there's a lot of federal money that's going to subsidize premiums for new customers for them. But something else that the Affordable Care Act did, I think, is not so obvious, which is that it started down the road of creating incentives for insurers not to just manage care the way they did in the 1990s, which was by saying, you know, we're not going to cover this, but to actually manage care according to how healthy their patients are, how well they do. And that, I think, is driving a lot of insurers to either develop that expertise or find someone who already has it.
And what does this mean for consumers if these insurers are going to get bigger? Is this like two airlines getting together, which means they're going to be more expensive flights, maybe fewer options, that it hurts the consumer to have such consolidation in the industry?
Well, that's certainly the concern, and one of my favorite headlines came from the Hartford Current this weekend, Hartford, home to many insurance companies. And it says, who will benefit from health insurance mergers? Not you, the consumer. But what really goes on in healthcare, it's a little bit different. We've seen a lot of consolidation, both on the insurer side and on the provider side, particularly growing hospital systems. Each one wants sort of to have a stronger hand in negotiations. Remember, insurers don't provide the care. Healthcare providers provide the care. And whichever one of them has more clout can demand either higher or lower prices, depending on what their goal is. So we've seen, you know, a lot of hospitals, in some cases, hospitals have more clout. They can extract higher prices from the insurers. In some cases, insurers have more clout, and they can extract lower prices from the hospital. So the consumer is kind of caught in the middle of this. But there is a large body of research that suggests that consolidation on either side, the insurer or the provider side, can end up in increased costs for consumers.
And is this a done deal, this huge merger, the Aetna-Humana merger? Is that going to make it through federal regulators? Are they going to face antitrust issues?
they will certainly get examined by antitrust regulators. Whether it will go through, in all likelihood, these are two companies that have kind of different areas of expertise. Humana has become kind of one of the market leaders in Medicare Advantage plans. Those are the private health plans for Medicare beneficiaries. Aetna is one of the major employer-provided insurance companies. So the idea is that they would create a synergy. There is some overlap in some states, I think particularly Florida, Texas, Ohio. But you could see the merger being approved and then them having to sell off some of the places where they would simply be, you know, too big for antitrust regulators.
And Julie, this reaction from these insurance companies to go forward with these mergers following the Supreme Court's decision, do you expect, as somebody who's covered this for years, that this is going to be the last big legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act, or are we likely to see another one next year or the year after that?
I think this is the last big challenge to the Affordable Care Act. There are a few that are still in the works. Obviously, the lawsuit filed by the House Republicans, which suggests that the federal government is illegally providing not subsidies, but what they call cost-sharing subsidies to certain low-income people, that they're using money that they're not allowed to use. So that's still out there. But I don't think that would have quite the impact, although it would have an impact on the insurance industry. It obviously wouldn't have had the impact that this last challenge had.
Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And let's turn now to fracking. While most of the focus about the side effects of fracking has been on drinking water, air pollution, earthquakes, regulators in Pennsylvania are working on another less discussed but no less serious result of oil and gas development: forest fragmentation. That's what happens when things like well pads, roads, pipelines crisscross the landscape and carve up large swaths of forest into small chunks. As Marie Cusick of WITF in Harrisburg reports, foresters are trying to help gas companies figure out the best ways to clean up after themselves.
In the 6 years since gas companies began fracking in Pennsylvania's state forests, none of the nearly 1,700 affected acres has been fully restored to the way it was before the gas boom began.
We are in the Tyodotten State Forest above Waterville, Pennsylvania. We are building a mock well pad to test different soil and ecological restoration techniques.
Kelly Sitch is a botanist with Pennsylvania's Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. He spends a lot of time in the woods, keeping an eye on how gas development is changing the landscape. This mock well pad is his latest research project.
And the overall goal of this is to figure out kind of how to put the forest back together, right?
Right. We want to go from a well pad that at the time is essentially non-forest to reclaimed site where we're kind of restoring ecosystem function.
This one-acre clearing is a scaled-down version of what would be left after a gas company has brought in the big drilling rig, finished up the fracking, and put the wells into production. So what's it look like? Well, the trees are gone, the soil is compacted, and there are lots of rocks lying around. State Forester Ben Gamble is digging through them as he plants saplings.
So we're in the process of loosening up some soil and planting some bare root seedlings in the area surrounding this pad. So there are a lot of stones up here. Some of the soils are mixed,
which is very much what we would see at many of the well pads following some sort of interim reclamation.
The research team here is trying to figure out different techniques to repair the forest after fracking companies are gone. On one end of the spectrum, they left the soil and compacted rocks and added topsoil. On the other end, they dug furrows nearly 2 feet down to loosen the ground, then added topsoil. Penn State University senior Bill Wall is among a group of students helping out.
At Penn State, you learn a lot about the Chesapeake Bay and fracking. Those are the two things that's pushed on our degree, but I've never been to a fracking pad, and I've never seen, like, you just look at it from Google Images. It's pretty eye-opening, I guess, that the fragmentation that occurs with the infrastructure that goes into developing natural gas.
Of the nearly 200 well pads in Pennsylvania's forests, only about 10 have been partially reclaimed, meaning some equipment has been removed and perhaps grasses, shrubs, or trees have been planted. Patrick Drohan hopes to find best practices companies can use now before they've packed up and left the area for good. Drohan teaches ecosystem science at Penn State's College of Agricultural Science. He's leading the research here.
What we're trying to do here is show how if you go a couple extra steps by alleviating that compaction and by diversifying your plantings, you can greatly improve that status quo. And so that can be used now.
Gas development is just the latest challenge for Pennsylvania's foresters, says Kelly Sitch from the State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources.
In my mind, this is just a new part of our mission to restore Pennsylvania forests. It's a little bit more complex. It's a little bit different than what we learned in ecology or forestry school, but it follows along those same lines.
Sitch's research team will be watching this patch of land for a long time to see which techniques work the best. It could be decades, even generations, until the state's forests fully recover from the natural gas boom. For Here and Now, I'm Marie Cusick.
And Marie's story comes to us from State Impact Pennsylvania, a public media project reporting on Pennsylvania's energy economy.
Remember that old diary you had growing up, the one that's probably stored away in your basement under lock and key now? Well, you may want to dig it up after listening to this. Grown-ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids. It's a podcast that encourages brave adults to share their childhood and teenage writing. Dan Meisner is the podcast creator and producer. He joins us from Toronto. Dan, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tell us about this podcast. Where did you get this idea?
So a couple of years ago, it was about 2007, my wife and I were visiting her parents and going through a bunch of old boxes in their basement, and we came across my wife's diary when she was, it was written when she was, you know, 12, 13, 14, kind of the awkward teenage years, the early teenage years.
Yeah.
And we were in the basement having a drink, reading her diary out loud to one another. And, you know, there were parts of it that were quite funny and there were parts of it that were kind of bittersweet. And it just sort of struck us that lots of folks probably have this kind of thing tucked away in their parents' basement or in a storage locker or in a box that they lug from apartment to apartment to apartment. So we basically booked a night at a bar, invited some friends, had some drinks, and we've been doing it ever since.
And I imagine some of the things that people wrote when they were kids are not things that they would want to be sharing now.
Well, and that is sort of the fundamental tension here, right, is that part of what makes this funny is that a lot of this stuff was never intended to be read on stage. It was never intended to be read by anybody ever, right? That's kind of what makes this stuff funny.
Well, let's listen. And we're going to be checking in with you now several times over the next several days to hear some of these stories that you have heard. And here's the first one that we've got here. This is Caleb. When he was 7 years old, he wrote a letter to the Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney. He had a plan for destroying nuclear bombs. Here he is.
To Mr. Mulroney, I would like to help to destroy bombs, make a suction cup like this, and there's the suction cup, to get to the army forces, use a drill like this, and there's laser beams coming out, and there's a Canadian flag in air coming out the back. The suction cup will stick to the bomb, it will suck the powder out. Take the huge drill for a test drive. If it works, go to the army forces right away, and then destroy the bombs. About myself. I am 7 years old. I go to Sansbury McTavish School. I have blue eyes. I have black and blonde hair. My favorite cooler is red. I have a nice smile. I have lots of fun every day. If you need help, I am here. Bye now from Caleb. And then I got a letter from the Prime Minister. And it says, "Dear Caleb," it's on fancy Prime Ministerial letterhead. And it says, "Dear Caleb, I would like to thank you very much for writing to me about world peace. As you know, I also have a family, and my four children have their own questions about the future of Canada and the world. I promise you now, as I have promised my own children, that I will do everything in my power as Prime Minister to work towards a more peaceful world for everyone. I am always very happy to hear from young people who show a concern for their nation and the world around them. It reassures me that in future generations, Canada will be left in caring hands. Thank you for writing. My children, Carolyn, Mark, Ben, and Nicholas, have asked me to send you their greetings. With every good wish, yours sincerely, Brian Mulrooney.
I just love my favorite cooler is red.
We get a lot of really, shall we say, creative spellings. I mean, the thing that strikes me about it is that it touches on this feeling that I had when I was a kid. Like, I remember really desperately wanting adults to take me seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, wanting to have some kind of meaningful interaction in adult conversations and just never quite being able to get there. So this idea that a 7-year-old with a suction cup could make, you know, meaningful change when it comes to nuclear disarmament, you know, it's charming, I think.
I remember writing a letter to Taco Bell corporate to tell them that I had figured out a way that they could make a disposable cup that would have like an accordion style thing in the middle so that you could take up less space in the trash with it.
My friend Garrett and I, growing up, wrote letters to sneaker companies with all sorts of sneakers we had designed, and we never, ever heard back from them.
So letters to sneaker companies or Taco Bell. That's Dan Meisner, founder and creator of the podcast Grown-Ups Read Things They Wrote as Kids. Each day this week, we're going to be chatting with Dan and featuring some of his favorite stories from the show. You can hear more from that podcast at our website, hereandnow.org.
Did you ever hear back from Taco Bell?
You know, I think they sent a letter sort of dismissing the idea. And then all of a sudden I noticed they started using those cups with the little accordions on. I never got any royalty payments or anything like that. I'm
Taco
still
Bell?
Working today, yes. Robin.
Write them again.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.